Welcome back to TRP.
Credited with being a painter, photographer, artist, sculptor, designer, architect, and matriarch of modernist furnishings. Who was Eileen Gray, you might well ask, and what was her connection with Wexford? Well, let's find out. Today, the house is better known as Brownswood House or Man's Skull Gorman, an Irish language secondary school on the outskirts of town, less than a mile south of St. Sennans, the now defunct psychiatric hospital on the main Enniscorthy to Wexford Road. It is an impressive 7-bay, 3-storey Victorian country house overlooking the River Slaney and the distant Blackstair Mountains. Eileen Gray was born Kathleen Eileen Moray Smith, the youngest of 5 children. Her father was James McLaren Smith, a Scottish landscape painter. Though Eileen's father was never considered an elite painter, he was in contact with many of the major painters of his day. Eileen's parents split up when she was 11 years old, and her father went to Europe to pursue his career. Although she missed her father terribly, she did manage to spend several painting holidays in his company. Her mother, Eveline Poundon, was great-granddaughter to Francis Stuart, the 10th Earl of Moray in Edinburgh, Scotland. She acquired the title Baroness Grey in 1895 on the death of her uncle. In the belief that such a title might open doors, Eileen's father decided he should change his name to Smith Grey. This he did by royal licence, and his 5 children took on the surname Grey. As children, they lived a privileged life, spending their summer holidays in Europe and their winter holidays in the Alps. When Eileen's older sister Ethel married Lord Lindsay's son Henry Tufnell Campbell in 1888, he instigated the modernisation of Brownswood by transforming the Georgian façade into a Victorian one. Eileen was horrified. She felt he had killed the essence of what her childhood home had been. Shortly afterwards, Eileen suggested to her mother that they should move to the family townhouse in Kensington. Though she visited Ireland in later life, she never did return to Brownswood. I suppose she cherished those wonderful childhood memories and had no desire to have them crushed by revisiting the house. In 1926, the house, including its stables for 20 horses, was auctioned off and bought by the Health Board. Because tuberculosis was rampant in Wexford at the time, it became a tuberculosis sanatorium. Later, it became an Irish school. Eileen left London to attend boarding school in Dresden, the city where her mother was born. It was only for a short time, and she relied on private tuition for her formative years. In 1900, she had to endure a double tragedy. She lost her brother to the Boer War and her father. He apparently died of natural causes. In an attempt to bolster her daughter's spirits, her mother took her to Paris, where she visited l'Exposition Universelle. This was to be a catalyst in young Eileen's life. She was captivated by Paris and the new, innovative force oozing from its core. She particularly loved the Palais d'Electricité, with its myriad of brightly shining bulbs, and the auto and aero exhibitions incited dreams of a fantastic new world. So taken was she that she implored her mother on her return to London to let her pursue a career in art, resulting in her enrolling in the Slade School of Fine Arts. It was situated in Bloomsbury in the heart of London. Teachers included Philip Wilson Steer, one of the leading landscape and seascape artists of the Impressionist movement, who had attended the Académie Julian in Paris and studied with Monet and Degas, and the renowned Frederick Brown, whose paintings, like the Impromptu Dance, gave us a wonderful insight into Victorian London. Some of Slade's school's notable illuminaries included Augustus John, the Irish painter William Orpin, Paul Nash, the British surrealist painter, and Dora Carrington, renowned for her association with members of the Bloomsbury group. Slade School had a reputation for being bohemian. At that time, the school attracted more female than male students. Perhaps fine art was not encouraged as a true profession for aspiring young men. They tended to seek the security of a well-imbursed position, not the vagrancies of an artistic life. And I say this somewhat facetiously, when they don't know where the next crust might be coming from. Despite the school's undoubted merit, Eileen was becoming disillusioned by her curriculum. By 1902, the Victorian age had come to an end, and wanting to embrace the rapidly evolving new world, Eileen set off for Paris with her friend Kathleen Bruce, a sculptress, who would become Baroness Kennett and marry Robert Falcon Scott, leader of the ill-fated Terra Nova expedition to Antarctica. They enrolled in the Académie Julian and the Académie Colarossi, where they befriended Augustin Rodin, the sculptor, and his American friend, the dancer, Isadora Duncan. Eileen had to return to London in 1905 due to her mother's ill health. While out walking one day, Eileen came upon Charles Dean's lacquerwork studio in Soho and was so captivated by the work, she implored him to give her a chance as an apprentice. She spent several months in the shop, acquiring the skills required, rubbing and sanding and applying new coats of lacquer to furniture. She returned to Paris when her mother's health improved, excited with the new skills she had learned, and immediately set about finding out who excelled in this craft in Paris. She soon met Saizo Sugawara, a student who had come to Paris during the exhibition and had loved it so much he wanted to stay. Sugawara, who had attended the Tokyo School of Fine Arts, was a master in 3D lacquering techniques. Though his skills were incredible, Eileen, undaunted, persevered. It was hard, sometimes arduous work, especially if one had to apply up to 30 layers of lacquer onto a piece of furniture, each time having to wait up to 3 days for a layer to dry before rubbing it down again and beginning the long, arduous task over and over till finally finished. Eileen contracted lacquer disease, a form of dermatitis that caused painful cracking of the skin in her hands, but ignored it with a shrug of her shoulders as if it was part of her initiation into the world of master craftsmanship. She managed to develop a blue lacquer, something even Sugawara thought impossible, but had the foresight to place a patent on her achievement. In 1910, she opened a lacquer workshop with Sugawara, a few streets away from her apartment, 21 Rue Bonaparte, in Saint-Germain-des-Prés. She wanted to make a bold statement, and she did just that by taking inspiration from a drawing she came across, reputedly of an incarcerated madman in La Salpêtrière Hospital, and set about creating a four-panel screen which she called Le Destin, the Destiny. It is indeed a striking piece, with its troubled figure of a man with bowed head and off-white shirt, carrying under his arm what appears to be his grey bed linen, his bold blue breeches contrasting with the vibrant orange and red, bleeding in and out of one another like a sanguine sunset, whilst in the background a slight blue figure appears to be almost dancing, perhaps to the music in his or her head. Eileen was to spend many months working on her piece, ignoring invitations to exhibitions by renowned artists and ignoring friends. Her hard work paid off. Monsieur Duquet, renowned for his Art Deco collection, fell in love with her piece, and though Eileen did not want to sell it, he pestered her till she did, asking her to sign it. Eileen signed it, Grey, 1914. It was to be the only piece she signed in her lifetime. Because of Eileen's lack of financial motivation for her art, Jacques Duquet became her mentor and helped to steer affluent Parisians to her work. Soon her name was tripping off the tongues of the artistic fraternity. Her lacquered screens were a must-have for the boudoirs of the rich and famous. Not content with success, she challenged herself again, and instead of a lacquered screen, she made a brick screen, consisting of black lacquered panels held on rods that could be opened or closed according to the degree of privacy required. With success came celebrity. Eileen began to dress in suits, she shortened her hair, and tended to mix in lesbian circles. She had lovers of both sexes, and made no attempt to hide the fact. One of her more serious affairs was with Maria Louise Damien, better known by her stage name Demia. She was one of the most famous singers of her day and adored by a legion of fans. Demia was like Eileen, dark-haired and spirited. She was the silent movie actress type, one with a white face and dark hypnotic eyes. They say that she and Eileen could often be seen together cruising up and down the boulevards of Paris in Eileen's soft top with Demi's pet panther sitting in the back seat. What a wonderful spectacle that must have been. Demi was one of Eileen's greatest loves, and she dedicated one of her most famous designs, the mermaid chair, to her. Their relationship ended in 1938, and though both of them were to live almost 40 more years in Paris, they were never to set eyes on each other again. Eileen was to have an affair with Romaine Brooke. She was born in Rome and became an American painter who, despite being lesbian, married John Etchingham Brooks, an unsuccessful pianist and a homosexual. Eileen did have a male lover. His name was Jan Badovici, a Romanian, 15 years her junior. He was an architect and a writer. It was he who first encouraged her to take an interest in architecture. He edited the French magazine for avant-garde architecture, L'Architecture Vivante. Tiring of Jeanne's dalliances, Eileen eventually ended their affair in 1932. It is claimed that the occultist and poet Aleister Crowley hooked up with her for a short time and that they were secretly engaged. I suppose in the occult, anything is possible. Eileen was bold and adventurous, and when she wasn't creating, she was travelling widely. It is claimed that she was one of the first women to hold a driving license in Paris. Eager to try out new things, she happily accepted the invitation of Charles Rolls, yes, he of Rolls-Royce fame, to go on a balloon flight. She loved it so much, she was determined to follow up on that initial baptism of air, as she called it. She is also credited with flying across the English Channel in 1913 in a biplane, piloted by the French lawyer and politician Henri Chiron, who was later to become Minister for Labour in the French government. A brave, perhaps foolhardy adventure, considering those planes were made mainly of canvas and that aviation was still in its infancy. Eileen's doggedness shone through, and eventually she got her pilot's license and was one of the first to fly the airmail plane from Mexico City to Acapulco. In 1934, she travelled to Mexico with her ex-lover Jan Badovici. Whether it was an attempt to rekindle their relationship is unknown, but they remained friends, and as we can tell, travelling companions. Whilst in Mexico, they met Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo. As I have mentioned previously, Badovici was the one who encouraged Eileen to consider architecture. He asked her to aid him in the restoration of several houses in the beautiful fortified town of Vézelay in the Bourgogne region. The town and its 11th century Romanesque Basilica of St. Magdalene are now designated UNESCO World Heritage Sites. It was around this time that Eileen was introduced to Le Corbusier, who took a rather dim view of an inexperienced woman attempting to step into the complex realms of architecture. Le Corbusier was at this stage a renowned and respected architect who had become friendly with Badovici. This brings me onto the house Eileen designed and had built for Badovici. She had always adored the sea and loved swimming and sunbathing. One day in 1925, whilst out walking, she found the perfect place, a little spot called Cap Martin, near Roquebrune. It is situated less than 4 kilometres from the Italian border to the east and 2 kilometres from the Principality of Monaco to the west. She was to put the deeds of E1027, her dream home, in Jan Badovici's name. What a crazy name for a house, you might say, but in fact it was a statement of their unity at the time. The E stood for Eileen, the 10 for the 10th letter of the alphabet, J, or Jeanne. The 2 represented B for Badovici and 7 for G. Eileen's surname, Gray. Eileen was 47 at the time, and though she had used Corbusier's template of open plan with a flat roof accessible by an internal stairwell, landscape windows, it was very much her design. When complete, she filled the house with her wonderful furniture. Set on a rock face and supported by pillars, the house had a superb vista of the massive rock of Monaco and part of the principality town. To the south was nothing but the blue Mediterranean. When finished, L'Architecture Vivante was to publish a complete article on E1027, praising its wonderfully innovative design and character. For a while, things seemed perfect. Eileen seemed to be ready to settle down, but her partner, Badovici, 15 years her junior, wasn't, and the spearing of his many dalliances with women half her age, she left him to set up home near Saint-Tropez. It was after Eileen had left Badovici that Le Corbusier stayed in E1027 and painted 6 sexually charged murals on the walls. Eileen was to see it as an act of vandalism. Perhaps Le Corbusier was envious of what Eileen had achieved. He did write to her and praised her for her work. But when speaking to Badovici, he told him he felt there was a lot of things that could be improved. During the war years, Eileen, as an alien, was forced to leave the coastal region of France and was forced to move inland to Lourmarin, a little town in the Vaucluse region. Le Corbusier actually tried to buy the house, but Badovici was not selling. And when he could not buy E1027, he bought land overlooking the property and built himself a cabane de vacances, a holiday home, a chalet really, void of any aesthetic beauty. Gray continued to see Badovici. Though they separated, they remained on good terms. But she refused to visit him in E1027, preferring to meet him in a quiet cafe or a bar or a restaurant. By this stage, she was living in the home she had designed in the village of Castellar, a mountainous region with spectacular views of the Mediterranean coast. By this stage, Eileen had little interest in lacquer and preferred the challenge of her architectural work. Eileen spent this time drawing, making sculptures and reading up on architecture. In 1944, her house in Castellar was ransacked and her rented apartment in Saint-Tropez destroyed by German bombing. E1027 had been taken over by the Germans. When eventually the Germans were forced out of France, she returned to Paris to her apartment number 21, Rue Bonaparte. On August the 17th, 1956, Badovici died with Eileen at his bedside. He had wanted to return the deeds of E1027 to Eileen, but died of liver failure before he could do so. Eileen arranged his funeral. Shortly after Badovici's death, Le Corbusier built a hostel on his property overlooking E1027. Badovici's sister, as nearest living relative, inherited the house. She was stuck in Romania and was prohibited from owning any property abroad. The house fell into disrepair. A wealthy Swiss widow was persuaded by Le Corbusier to buy the property. When she saw it, she was horrified, but Le Corbusier convinced her it was a good investment. In 1960, the house was put up for auction. The widow, Marie-Louise Chalbert's bid, won the day. E1027 had received a reprieve. Though Chalbert made some alterations, she treated the house with the respect it deserved. Le Corbusier, now at the height of his fame, brought architectural students to stay in the hostel and to admire Eileen's house. The problem was, by now, Le Corbusier was claiming the credit for the design and build. In 1965, on the 27th of August, Corbusier went for his morning swim and died of a massive heart attack. The walkway to the sea was to become known as Promenade Le Corbusier. He was buried in the nearby village of Roquebrune. On October the 31st, 1976, Eileen, as a result of a fall, was to die in her Rue Napoleon apartment. She was interred a week later in Père Lachaise Cemetery with nothing more than a simple grave number, 17616, to mark her resting place. In 1980, the owner of E1027, Marie-Louise Chalbert, was found dead in her Zurich apartment. It is claimed that 3 days prior to this, her physician, a Dr. Peter Cagey, had removed most of the original furniture from the house and auctioned it in Zurich. Oddly, it was the doctor who was to inherit the house after Chalbert's death. He treated it as his party house for drug-fueled orgies. Apparently, in 1996, he picked up 2 young men and brought them back to E1027. Whatever happened, he was stabbed to death and found lying in the bedroom soaked in his own blood. After his death, the house fell into ruin. All attempts to preserve the building fell on deaf ears. It was only when, in 1989, a screen Eileen had made for Badovici sold for $374,000 that people began to take notice. In 2009, her dragon chair, once owned by Yves Saint Laurent, sold for a staggering €19.5 million. In 1996, Patrick Mellett, an Irish architect, tried to interest the Irish government in buying E1027 as part of the Imaginea Irlandaise festival in France. The house was on the market for roughly €400,000, the price of a terraced house in Cabra at the time. But the Irish government claimed they could not spare the money. Patrick Mellett was infuriated. He wrote to Liz McManus, Minister for Housing and Urban Renewal. He received a reply 5 months later saying, though she supported the idea, there were no funds at her disposal. Perhaps that was true, but she must know the value of culture, living as she does in a house once lived in by James Joyce. Mellett then wrote to Michael D. Higgins, but did not even receive a reply. The irony of this story is that the French government decided to save E1027, not because it was Eileen Gray's project, but because it contained 6 murals painted by Le Corbusier. Whatever the real reason, we should be happy that the house has been restored to its former glory and is now a UNESCO World Heritage Site. A permanent exhibition of Eileen's work can be seen in Collins Barracks, Dublin, and in Enniscorthy Castle, the town of Eileen Gray's birth.
Please tune in to our next episode.